in the land of the free at the moment, in the USA. There's American soldiers out fighting for democracy. What do you think of democracy in America and freedom?
I think you can get the best democracy you can pay for in this country. And we'll leave it at that.
It's an interesting question. I've heard some comments saying that why don't we just give Iraq our constitution since we're not using it?
Bill Maher. Yeah, like I was going to say, I mean, like, I think it depends upon how much money you have and what color your skin is. I think that those are the fundamental things. And a lot of the freedoms that we enjoy are not at all, you know, everything is based upon civil rights as opposed to human rights. And civil rights can be very easily changed on a piece of paper. But the rights that we're supposed to enjoy are given to us by a higher natural power and not by some constitution that's easily changed by white men with power.
There's so much apathy out there now. What's our hope? Is there any way of changing it? I mean, as an outsider, the Democrats and the Republicans don't seem to be that different. It's just, what sort of way? Is it through the ballot box, or is there any other way that things can be done?
I think there's other ways things can be done. You can vote for Nader like I did, because he's one of the free voices out there that can speak from his gut instead of from his pockets.
This is Ralph Nader.
Yeah, Ralph Nader.
Okay, the Green Party.
Well, historically, most of the change has not come through ballot boxes. It's come through direct action. I'm talking, of course, about the 60s and the civil rights movement. And War of Independence, we tried to gain our inalienable rights from the British tyrants. And now some people are trying to gain inalienable rights from other tyrants.
I think that a lot of the changes need to come from regular people changing their lifestyles. I think that I agree with Dennis that it takes a lot more than just individual actions. I think that what we need is just more self-sufficiency and people making actions in their daily lives. Like, it can't just be marching in the streets once a year or voting once a year. It needs to be in your consumption decisions, like whether you buy fair trade versus free trade, you know, what kind of movements you support and also what kinds of communities you support. If you have a community that entertains each other and provides for each other without the state, without television, you know, like without all these things that are exploiting other people, then I think that's how we build a new society, and it has nothing to do with Republicans or the Democrats.
Can I add something too? Yeah. And I also wanted to say that people have to realize that we're the government, and we represent the government, and we should, you know, harass our local officials and realize that, you know, our taxes go to funding this war, so we have our own interests, and we have a right to stick up for what our money is going towards, like preferably education or something like that.
Yeah.
Or healthcare.
In addition, you mentioned a difference between Democrats and Republicans, and for the majority, there is no difference between a Demo-Publican and a Republican. It's two wings of the capitalist party, and capitalism is ruining most of what we have left of this planet and any sort of rights that we have as human beings. And I consider myself a citizen of the world. I don't consider myself a citizen of the U.S., even though it says that on my passport. And that's a huge difference, because once you think in a global perspective, then you can understand that anyone who's been deemed an enemy is just another human. It's a very dehumanizing sort of process that war begins with. You define us versus them. I mean, this was very clear in the Bush rhetoric before going into Afghanistan and Iraq. And you have to be literate in the media. And to that end, I mean, personally, I'm organizing a film festival at the university that's going to go into issues of consciousness raising in terms of general political awareness on top of very issue-specific sort of things. And if you confront people with the ugly truth right off the bat, you're going to lose them. So we're going to do this in a progressive way, starting with some laughs and getting people to understand that there are more serious issues that are going on. So use political comedians like Chris Rock and George Carlin. Get them to laugh. And once you have them laughing, you'll have their attention and they'll be more prone to go into more special issues, things that concern them. And politics is all around us. Politics is everything. It's everywhere. And controls what you're allowed to see, what you're allowed to say, what rights you're allowed to have, and what everything that comes on the outside of that as well.
I have to agree with Dennis. I mean, like, it's such a difficult world that we're living in, and we see so much exploitation going on, so much suffering, and a lot of it is connected with our consumption patterns. And the thing is that we've got to have a lighthearted spirit, and I look at the St. Patrick's Four and how kind they are and how loving they are and how positive they are, and that's what we need. We need to have mutual support and positiveness if we're going to fight all of these destructing things, because otherwise the human race is going to self-destruct.
There's two questions left now, that's all, okay? The first one is, I want to ask you about the democratizing effects and maybe perhaps a blueprint for new models that the internet affords, maybe one of equality, everybody's sort of equal on the internet, and what that means for media, but also what it means for democracy.
Well, I think the internet is a great thing, and there isn't a news filter there, but the only thing is the internet's only available to people that can afford the internet, and people that should be the most politically active often don't have the opportunity to use those resources.
Yeah, the U.S. Census in 2000 determined that of 300,000 official Americans listed, only one-third had access to the internet, and as James already stated, it's the more affluent people, and those are the people who are generally the ones in power and the ones who are most concerned with keeping themselves in power. And that tends to be a very undemocratic situation when you only have a minority. The moral majority, as they call themselves, representing what is actually the true majority.
Yeah, I have to agree with both of them that there's definitely a class issue when it comes to technology. And I think that more people could be employed by using a little bit less technology sometimes. You know, but... you know, to be honest, I mean, not to sound Orwellian here, but the thing is that when all information is sort of diverted to the internet, things can be changed extremely easily. You know, it's one thing to sort of raid libraries and destroy books, but it's very easy. It just takes a few clicks of a button to erase something permanently from the internet. So, like, for example, I know the Chicago Tribune had a case where a woman investigated and wrote about Chiquita Bananas and how they treat their workers. And Chiquita Bananas was an advertiser, and not only did they pull their advertising and the woman lost her job, but then the Chicago Tribune totally deleted that series from their archives. And so it's as if, though, that story did not exist. So this is a story only about bananas. Imagine what could happen intergenerationally between what's happening now and the future. And even right now, there's a lot of stuff that we're missing, whether it's from people who don't have access to media, or whether it's media that can be very conveniently destroyed. You know, so something like the memoryhole.org, I think it's called, you can go there. And I know that the Abu Ghraib pictures actually first showed up there. That was where I first learned about them, because they were out there on the internet, but nobody saw them. It wasn't until the New York Times picked up on it. So,
but I myself think that, say, there's 3G phones and mobile phones even in Africa now, 3G phones, they're sort of doing the leapfrog, a technological leapfrog over, and sometimes very often they're technologically more developed in parts of Africa than they are in the West, because they've got newer computers, newer models, and it's very difficult to take anything off the internet unless you get hold of the server that puts it up there. So if you've got your own servers, so IndyMedia, for instance, have their own servers, so they have to...
Three of their own servers.
Okay, well, they did now, but other parts of the world, that's just a networking, a case for networking, and where people can hold and store information on vulnerable people's behalf, and then put them back up easily enough if that happens, you know. But China, for instance, has no IndyMedia, and yet Chinese people use external sources for information all the time, and they value it a hell of a lot. But you're dead right, 23% of the population of America are below the poverty line. Two-thirds of the Irish population have no access to internet, and it's catching on. I think there's hope for myself, but... Well, anyway, the final question is, whether it's artificial or not, there's an oil crisis at the moment, the rest of the world. It probably hasn't been felt in America so much yet. And the oil, it factors into everything we buy. Inflation for transport, for electricity, for people's wages and everything. When this crisis does come, the alternative resources or sources of energy have not been used. Will America, for instance, have the ability to... It seems to have outsourced all its industry to places where... Or the bosses have, to places where work is far cheaper. So what will America have? What will the people have? Perhaps everybody be affected. How can this be counteracted?
Jeez.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
That's a big one.
It's a big essay.
Well, you have to start with the fact that industrial society is completely unsustainable. And... The one big thing is that this country, you have to realize that we can't have exponential growth obsessed with it.
Based on a
finite resource. And oil is completely... When you have so many people depending on one thing, I think it's very dangerous. But I have some more faith than a lot of people in the human race. And I think that we'll be able to evolve and make changes. And I think all of our problems now, based on, you know, all this mindless consumption and everything, will eventually... All the excess will disappear and people will become more sustainable, and hopefully like a more egalitarian type of society will evolve.
Uh-huh.
Hopefully.
Oh boy, the oil crisis. Well,
I don't think it
was in the 1940s.
Oh yeah, come back
and stop now.
It was in the 1940s that the petrologist Hubbard, famous for formulating the Hubbard peak, was able to apply... He took a very basic mathematical concept, which is the bell curve. Basically, most natural systems work on the top half of the sine wave, which is, if you can imagine, to take that bell curve and apply it towards petroleum. We all know that petroleum is a finite resource, and Hubbard predicted that right about now we would be hitting the peak of our oil supply globally. And I was actually quoted in the campus paper for saying this. I went along the lines of basically, it doesn't matter where you go to war from now on, because there is no more cheap oil. It's only going to get more expensive. And I definitely do have faith in the ingenuity of all people, not even just the U.S. people, to overcome things. I mean, the human civilization and species has been around for millennia, and they've managed to make it through ice ages and all sorts of natural disasters. And this is a man-made disaster. I know personally that there are firms in upstate New York manufacturing solar panels, and the ironic part about it is that Bush went to war in Iraq and Afghanistan for oil, but yet his ranch in Crawford, Texas is solar powered. I have seen this film called The End of Suburbia, and basically what it posed there was, okay, so we're in an oil crisis. It's a very interesting film because it presents the way the U.S. post-World War II urban sprawl and all these things have been affected by oil. It was formulated basically by cheap petroleum and automobiles as well. So they pose the question, all right, so we ran out of oil, and so what are we going to do about it? Many people were very discouraged, and I was certainly not discouraged, because when the end of every story is the beginning of a new one. So this might be the end of suburbia and the end of oil. However, it is the beginning of sustainability, the birth of sustainability by necessity. Necessity is the mother of all invention, and you have to hold out hope, and I have that hope.